Do you ever wonder what's happening behind the scenes of the multi-trillion dollar fashion industry? In the new podcast, Fashion People, Puck correspondent and 20-year fashion veteran Lauren Sherman and a rotating cast of industry insiders discuss what fashion people are really talking about behind the scenes of the star-studded business, from creative director switcheroos to M&A drama, DTC downfalls, and Met Gala mishaps. Fashion People, a presentation of Odyssey in partnership with Puck, is available now wherever you get your podcasts.
I am here, and I'm sorry it took so long.
That's
I was getting angry texts.
Oh, whoa, holy cow, holy cow.
No, I guess it's
Drew's like,
time
oh,
to
Molly's
begin.
Here, boom!
Oh, okay. Well, to be fair, I was a little late. Oh, hi, everyone. I'm Molly Wood. I'll stop talking about how I'm late to the show that's already happening because you don't know I'm late. You're listening right on time. Welcome back to Make Me Smart, the podcast where we make today make sense. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, my goodness. When we show up. I'm Kai Rosdahl. What Do You Want to Know Wednesday? The day in the week where we get to answer some of the questions all y'all send our way. So we will do that today.
Yeah, I peeked ahead. We got some fiscal policy geeks up here today, and I'm stoked. Let's get to our first one of many.
All right.
Hi, Molly. My name is Sasha. I'm calling from Karabasset Valley, Maine. And I'm curious if you could make me smart about the really practical implications of failing to raise the debt ceiling. I've heard that will collapse the global economy, and it sounds really bad, but I don't quite understand how exactly my life on the ground would change and the implications for sort of everyday people and everyday life. Thanks so much. Bye.
Okay, so
before we begin, I have a fun fact about Karabasset Valley.
Oh, okay. I was going to say that's an awesome
I looked
place
it up,
by the way.
I know, and it sounded so charming, and I was like, what is the deal? And it seems like one of the better known things about Karabasset Valley is something called the anti-gravity complex, which I got really excited about, but just wanted to let you know it appears to be a fancy indoor skate park. I know. I was like, dude, I love this town. And then I was like, a bunch of kids skateboarding. I'm like, oh, okay. But still, it looks like a really very charming town. Okay. Now, please, do the substance.
So, briefly, as briefly as I possibly can, because I could go on about this for bleeping ever. So practical implications for people on the ground. If you know somebody who gets a Social Security payment, who gets a Medicare payment, who gets a child tax credit payment, who goes to a medical facility where doctors are paid by the government, anybody who gets any kind of support from the federal government should be worried about the debt limit, because what's going to happen on the day that the debt limit blows up, which currently is the 18th of October, so said Janet Yellen yesterday, is that the Treasury Department is going to prioritize paying off the bonds that it has issued. And it's going to do that because the U.S. Treasury market, the bonds that the government sells to finance all the stuff we have in this country that the government pays for, it is the most liquid, it is the biggest, and it is the most sure thing debt market in the world. You will always get your money back if you lend the American government money. We hope. Okay? And Treasury is going to work really hard to make sure that still happens. So they're going to make those interest payments. They're going to make the coupon payments on the bonds. What does that mean, though? If they can't borrow more money to do that, that means that they can't pay some other bills. Medicare, Social Security, military. They just cannot do it. They literally don't have any money. So that's how you will be directly affected. The other larger implication of this is that if somehow the Republicans in Congress can't see their way clear to the traditionally bipartisan chore of raising the debt limit, artificial though it may be, the global economy is going to crater, because not only will we enter a huge recession where Moody's estimates we're going to lose 5 million jobs and trillions of dollars in wealth, but also nobody's going to lend us money. Nobody's going to lend us money. Nobody's going to buy our bills. Nobody's going to buy our bonds. Nobody's going to buy our notes. That's how it would affect you. Listen to Marketplace today. We did 2 minutes right at the top of the show on exactly this topic. There you go. Yeah.
Remember some other time recently when I was on the show and I was talking about that newsletter, Heather Cox Richardson, and I said that starving the United States economy is just as deadly to it as taking up arms against it? That's what he means.
Yeah, that's this.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's really bad. It's really bad.
Wow.
Yeah.
We should definitely just fool around with that, though, and play politics. That sounds fun.
We definitely should. Definitely should. Jenny in Virginia wants to know this. Why is childcare so expensive and still such a low-paid job? Where is the money going? Whew, that's a great question. Holy cow.
I know, seriously. Yeah, and what is remarkable about that is because is that everybody needs it, or so many people. Yep. Not everybody, obviously, but lots of people do. So some numbers up front. First of all, the average cost of childcare in the United States stands at more than $8,000 a year. The median pay is about $12.24 per hour. And apparently one of the reasons is because if you have, you know, if you're a quality childcare center, you have to have a lot of staff. You have to have a lot of employees so that you can have a low child-to-staff ratio. Mm-hmm. Labor costs account for 80% of a childcare center's budget. So if you are essentially a small business and that's all you can afford, that's what happens, right? You just don't pay as much. Childcare centers, of course, have to pay rent in increasingly expensive housing markets. There's liability insurance, licensing fees, and these really, really narrow margins. And the only way it works out is to run at full capacity. If they raise pay for workers, that means parents will have to pay more, and parents might not be able to do that or not be willing to do that. So this is why, of course, we're having these conversations about universal pre-K, subsidies for childcare that are based on your income, and all of these other ways to make childcare more affordable for people, because making it more expensive is just going to mean that, like, poor people can't have childcare and rich people can. And you just further this inequality and keep people from being able to go back to work in some cases. But either way, obviously, it's a huge concern. We brought it up the other day on the show and said that all these childcare workers are quitting because they can make more money who knows where. Childcare employment is down 126,000 positions. Yes, and of course, what this primarily impacts is women and mothers who can't go back to work.
Yep. And look, obviously, as Molly said, you know, people at the upper end of the income spectrum don't have this problem the same way that folks on the lower end do, because mostly they can afford it. But I talked to Indra Nooyi on Marketplace yesterday, the former chairman and CEO of PepsiCo. And she was like, I took the job at PepsiCo 25 years ago, and my mother moved in with us so that I could have childcare, right? So they could be nearby. Yeah. I mean, it's a real freaking thing. Yeah.
I mean, people put it together in all kinds of different Django ways. And it's, I mean, honestly, when my kid went from daily, you know, daycare to public kindergarten, I was like, we are rich. that first school auction that I went to, I was like, oh, yeah, give me all of it.
It's a honestly, like the first 5 years of
bill.
It's crazy. The first 5 years of life, there is nothing more stressful, I swear to God, than childcare, right? Honestly.
I know.
It's what are we going to do with the kid today, right? Yeah.
And that, I would like to point out, is a very special feature of the American system.
Yeah.
Like, we're it. In terms of advanced economies, or whatever we're calling them, the United States is the one without universal childcare. The one.
Yeah.
It's embarrassing, and it needs to stop. Oh, hey, look, Congress, what a segue. Recently, the House passed a $768 billion defense bill, which is more than what was proposed in the president's budget, President Biden's budget. So Richard in California wanted to know, how exactly does the Department of Defense spend its money? Oh, the eternal question.
So let's
$10,000 toilets.
First of all, that's right. $10,000 toilets. But we'll get to that in a second. But let's put this into context, right? $750-ish billion. That's for 1 year, right? God. The Biden human infrastructure plan that Congress is now the Democrats, right? Because the Republicans are sitting back and watching and you know, rubbing their hands together with glee. But the Democrats are tying themselves in a knot over the president's $3.5 trillion bill. That is $3.5 trillion over 10 years. So the president's infrastructure bill is half the size annually of the Pentagon's budget annually. So there's that. The Peterson Foundation says about 40% goes to operations and maintenance, 23% goes to personnel, paying the people, right? 20% goes to buying weapons systems, and 14%-ish or so goes to research and development for new weapon system. There's another study that says nearly half of defense spending, broken down in those categories, since September 11th, has gone to private contractors. But, and here's my favorite but most hateful part of the Pentagon budget, We don't actually know this because it wasn't until a couple of years ago that the Pentagon was actually required statutorily to audit itself. And in point of fact, every audit it has ever done, it has failed. Like if you ran a company and your local accountants came in and said, no, 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 we're going to not give you an unqualified review. That's what has happened to the Defense Department every time they've had to be audited. Right. The auditors have said, no, this is garbage, man. Are you kidding me? Are you kidding me? So now there is an Audit the Pentagon Act of 2021, which would take any element of the Defense Department, which is to say Army, Navy, Marine Corps, I guess Coast Guards and Homeland Security, but some anyway, whatever, the biggies, you know them. If it can't pass an audit, would forfeit 1% of its budget back to the Treasury, and then that would be applied against the federal deficit. So the defense budget is rightly scorned for being a mess, but it's enormous. It's an enormous mess. Yeah.
I just totally want to go back to the if we were to spend $700 billion a year for 10 years, that would be twice the price tag of the Biden human infrastructure plan.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Imagine if we spent $700 billion a year on like climate adaptation and resilience and solutions. Just as one example. Yeah. Wait. Well, look, imagine if we spent $100 billion a year on universal child care.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
And look, the Pentagon has been so smart about this because, not the Pentagon. The Congress is, well, Pentagon as well, right? But what happens is there are defense contractors and installations in every single state, right? So all 435 members of the House have a vested interest in that spending. All 100 senators, all 50 governors. Right. They've all got a vested interest in this spending. And that's why it keeps on going. Beware, as Dwight Eisenhower said, the military industrial complex. It's a real thing.
Yeah, it's a real thing. It's a real thing. Yeah. And it's a guaranteed moneymaker. Because even though we, for example, just pulled out of a 20-year war, Congress gave the Pentagon more than the administration had asked for.
Yeah.
More.
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah.
Happens all
that's where the pork is. All right. Our last question today comes from Patricia in Arizona, who asks, what are hawks and doves in relation to monetary policy? Really fair question. Like this we should be
totally
definitely defining this every time.
So hawks, when you're okay. So when you're talking hawks and doves in monetary policy, literally imagine the birds, right? The hawks are raptors. They have sharp talons, pointy beaks for ripping apart their prey, really good eyes to see with, right? And those are the people, when you're talking about monetary policy, who are really worried about inflation, who do not want inflation to get out of control, even a tenth of 1% year on year, right? They want to kill it as soon as they possibly can because they worry that inflation, once started, will run out of control. The doves, on the other hand, are the people who are like, yeah, inflation's fine. Let's worry about the labor market and workforce and pay levels and those kinds of things. And it kind of helps if you think of people when you think of this. So I don't know how many of you out there will remember or have heard of Paul Volcker, used to be chairman of the Fed back in the early 1980s, appointed by Carter. And then in the early 80s, when inflation was at like 14 and 16%, he crushed inflation. He was an inflation hawk, right? Janet Yellen, Ben Bernanke, inflation doves. They're like, yeah, you know, inflation's fine. Let's worry about the labor force. And so that's where it goes. That's how it comes from. Yeah.
I actually just learned in our prep notes, thank you producers right here, that evidently there is in fact a third bird, which I want to say all day, every day, third bird, a pigeon. The people who sit somewhere in the middle. I didn't believe that at all. But then I looked in this story that we did on Marketplace ages ago from David Gura, and pigeon is actually in here.
Yep.
Pigeons.
Yep.
That is hilarious. Yep. I'm going to strive to be a fiscal pigeon. But now I don't want to tell anybody I'm a fiscal pigeon because it's very embarrassing. We need a better third bird.
Yeah, well, that's the problem, right? Because pigeon carries all kinds of connotations, right? Oh, you're such a pigeon.
Yeah.
You know, I
don't want to be a fiscal flying rat. Come on. Give me a better. We need your help, friends. A better bird. Right. Tell us your suggestions for the third bird.
And while you do that, think about how you're going to get them to us, right? Because we're done for today. Back tomorrow on Holla.Shell Thursday. Send us your questions, would you, or your comments, or your bird suggestions. Make me smart. And did you see, by the way, that the Lord God bird, the ivory-billed woodpecker, is now extinct? And there are a whole bunch of others listed today? Craziness.
Yeah.
Craziness.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's
bad. Make Me Smart. Sorry, that was a weird turn. Make Me Smart at marketplace.org. Leave us a voicemail if you like. 508-827-6278. 508-UB-SMART.
It's like you said hollowed out Thursday and then you had to skip ahead.
I know, right?
To the hollowing.
Like, what's the matter with you? Yeah.
On the other hand, if you see a Make Me Smile and you want to share that with us, please do, and we will use them on the show. Make Me Smart is produced by Marissa Cabrera. Today's program was engineered by Charlton Thorpe, and our intern is Grace Rubin.
You missed us yesterday, by the way. Yesterday was Marissa's one-year anniversary on the show.
I can't believe I missed it. I'm sorry.
It's all good. Ben Talladay and Daniel Ramirez composed our theme music. Our senior producer this week is Bridget's off doing something. I don't know what. Is Donna Tam. Okay, now I'm checking the slide.
Wow. What a good year. Who has had a more impactful first year than Marissa?
Oh, nobody, for sure.
Crushed it.
Totally true.
Crushed
it. Totally true.
Every bit of it.
All right. And here come the fire trucks to take us away. All right.
All right. See you guys tomorrow.
Everybody all right?
I'm fine, bye. Unless you want to credit the right engineer.
Oh, no.
Oh, no. Snap. Today's program was engineered by Drew Jostad.
Oh, my goodness.
Dang. Wait until the last nanosecond, P.S.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.